Falling in love is wonderful and awful. And the reason it's both can be summed up in a single word: vulnerability. That feeling permeates a song I wrote on my keyboard way back in the 90s. It's sappy but sincere, and it makes the point.
These are the things that I want. These are the things I require. It scares me to even speak words or whisper my needs or even believe.
You see, the problem with love is that it requires you to hand over the most vulnerable part of yourself and trust that other person will not step on it or squish it, or in some cases, hand it back. Growing up as a very awkward, nerdy, gay kid, I think I experienced all of those things. There were highs, like when a friend revealed a crush on me by writing a poem. And there were lows, like the time I discovered an ex standing in the rain outside my apartment one morning, silently watching as I got into my car to leave. Love can be delirious, and love can be dangerous. I'm Christopher Wynn, and this is Strange. When it comes to dating, Sarah Heppala might describe her history as, well, complicated. For many years, the thing she did with the most passion was drink. Her New York Times bestselling memoir is called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. These days, she's sober and thriving in Dallas, but there is one memory that still lingers. It's a story that begins in New Orleans French Quarter at 1 a.m. It involves a gun, a romance, and, well, like I said, it's complicated. Here's Sarah.
So this was 2006, and I was in New Orleans for a friend's wedding. And I was walking home with two friends from the rehearsal dinner back to the hotel that I was staying at on Royal Street. And I felt this tug on my purse, and then I felt this like thwack on my head, and I thought one of the tiles had fallen off from the roof and hit me on the head, but then I turned around and there was this kid holding a gun. So he said, "Give me the bag, bitch." And I was like, "Well, that's a pretty good argument. I think I'll do that." I wasn't thinking, of course, I just did it on instinct. And then he pointed the gun at my friend James, who was right next to me, and he said, "Give me your money." And James was like, "I don't have any money." And he was like, "Well, give me your wallet." And he was like, "Well, I don't have a wallet," which was a lie, actually. But because of that extended period of time, I got a very good look at this person. Like, it totally seared on my brain. Anyway, the guy that was robbing us, he ran off. There was another guy there. And so we're just standing there, like the three of us, standing on Royal Street, you know, three mugged tourists in the French Quarter, you know, called the cops. Cops came, and then this detective shows up. And I remember the detective because it was so weird to see somebody come to your crime scene in this nice suit. You see that on the shows all the time, that they wear suits all the time. But you don't realize, like, when it happens and, like, this violent crime has happened to you and then somebody walks in wearing a suit, it's like they've showed up to prom or something. It's very strange. We called him the Dapper Detective after that. He took our statements. And he did the detective things that they do in the movies, right? You know, he talked to you, got your statement. He gave us a ride back to the hotel. He wanted to take me to the hospital because I had a big lump on my head, but I didn't have insurance, so I said no. I'd been pistol whipped. That was what had happened to me, by the way. I didn't understand that because I hadn't seen it, but I'd been hit with the gun, the guy's gun. I never thought I would hear from that detective again, ever. I thought that would just be like, he took our statement and that's it and that's done. That's the end of the story. But what ended up happening was, several months later, he sent me a photo lineup to see if I could identify the person. I was able to identify the person because I was the only one of us that could identify the person. I was flown down to New Orleans for a pre-motion trial, which is like a trial to see if they're gonna have a trial. So I was flown down. The whole experience, having to go testify, all that stuff, it sounds really cool if like me, you're like a true crime junkie, you know, oh, that's great. Oh, you're at a trial. Ooh, that's exciting. You gotta take the oath. No, it was horrible. The whole thing was horrible. The main reason that it was horrible, there are two reasons. One of them is that the guy that had mugged me was sitting there. And so he's sitting there in an orange jumpsuit on the defense side. And I, because I was trying to be a tough girl, was making eye contact with him the whole time. And so during my testimony, when I was describing him at some point, I described him as good looking. And I happened to be looking at him at the time and he winked at me. And I was like super unmoored by this and super creeped out by this. There's no jury in a pre-motion trial. So the judge is looking at me, the lawyers are looking at me, he's looking at me, he winks at me. And I got like, I unraveled and I started crying. And then I was like, like trying to like suck in my tears. But there I was like choking on them. They had to like stop the trial. And they were like, all right, we need to get her some water. And by the way, the whole audience is filled with these other guys that are waiting for their pre-motion trial in their orange jumpsuits. So they're just like, ooh, pass the popcorn. Like, this is exciting now. There's a girl crying up there. And then the other part of it that was really horrible that I didn't expect, he had this really pit bull public defender, as he should have, you know. He had somebody that was really throwing down to protect him, but part of that meant tearing apart my story. And why didn't I remember this? And why didn't I remember that? Isn't it weird that I don't remember this, but I do remember that? And I'm like, no, it's not weird. A year has passed. I can hardly remember what I did yesterday. It's not weird. But he's trying to pick holes in my memory and my account of that night to defend his client and to give his client the best defense possible. I felt like the criminal, like I was on trial. My memory was on trial for having been smacked over the head with a gun. And it was an experience I didn't quite understand until that moment. And I don't know that I was fully prepared for it. Anyway, the detective that was on the case, he was there that day. He wasn't in that courtroom. He was also a witness, so he was sitting out in the holding area. And when we got done with the afternoon, he was like, let's go to lunch. He was just like, let's get out of here. I think he felt terrible that I had been mugged at gunpoint in his city, and then I had come back to testify in his case, and something happened on that stand that was so upsetting that I had been crying in public. Like, this city isn't cutting her a break, so he's like, I'm gonna take you to lunch. So we went to lunch. We just had the most charming, wonderful conversation. It lasted like 3 or 4 hours. And it was like, I'd only met detectives from The Wire, which is a really funny thing that I would say. Because that's how I felt. I've been very, very big fan of the show The Wire. And so it was funny to me, because when I met him, I was like, I expected him to be like that. And he wasn't. He wasn't like a tough guy. He was nice. And he was very, I thought he was kind of chivalrous and funny and smart and thoughtful, wanted to talk to me about writing and stuff like that. And he loved romantic comedies. And I realized that, like, we both just had these different forms of escape, you know, that, like, I had this safe life, and so I liked crime land dramas and, like, gangster movies. And then he had this really violent world that he lived in, so he liked these stupid, safe, dumb romantic comedies. Anyway, I went home, never thought I was going to see him again, but as a gift for being so kind to me, I sent him the first season of The Wire, because I told him, if anybody's going to change your mind about crime drama, it's going to be David Simon and me. And so I sent it to him, And then I didn't hear back from him for a while, and then I got this, like, handwritten note. Like, who writes a note? Like, who writes a note? And he'd sent me two books about New Orleans, and then they just started this correspondence. The correspondence kind of moved to email, and then the email correspondence moved to phone, and then before long, we were, like, having these long phone conversations with each other, and he had moved to homicide, and I was really fascinated by that, because who isn't fascinated by a homicide detective? What that world is like. So that went on for like 6 months, and you know, it's just a strange intimacy that you can have with somebody that is like 1200 miles away. Maybe because they're 1200 miles away, like you can let that person close. After the case was closed, that's when I was like, oh, I felt like I had really fallen for this person. And I decided I wanted to go down to New Orleans and visit him as a civilian, you know, as not a victim in a case that he was working on, but as a person who wanted to know him better. So I flew down to New Orleans, and I think I was supposed to stay for 2 days or 3 days, and I stayed for 5 days. I just skipped my flight back. I just was like, I'm not going to take that. And we just had this amazing time. And I remember we went to this cop bar, one of these long railroad-style, shotgun-style bars, you know, just clogged with people. It looked just like The Wire. Like, it looked just like The Wire. And when they go to that bar, and they're all drinking too much, and they're all talking about cases, and they're, like, somebody put that Pogue song on the jukebox, like, Fairy Tale in New York. Everybody was singing it. And I remember Nick and I were dancing to like a Frank Sinatra song. And I remember when it was done, he turned around and he put money in the jukebox and he just played it again. And then we just danced again. It was so great. And I was like, I am so in love with this person. Like, I was just like knocked out with the love that I felt for this person. You know, I knew I was in love with him. So that relationship went on for 6 months. And I went to New Orleans several times. I thought I was going to marry him. I thought we were going to have children together. I thought I was going to leave New York, which is where I was living at the time, and moved to New Orleans. And then very suddenly, he broke up with me. He just called me one night and he was like, I can't do this. I think we got carried away. I don't feel the same way about you. And I always think it's interesting that the story began when I got hit on the head. And then that moment always felt like I was getting hit on the head again. Like, it was as sudden and emotionally violent. I remember I told him, I said, hold on, I'm gonna call you back, I need to go throw up. And I just ran to the bathroom and threw up. And then I called him back. And then he didn't have a really good answer, and it all had to do with him. And you deserve someone better. I remember that one. I remember you deserve someone better, and I just said, fuck you. I never got a good reason. And I searched for a really, really long time. And I was really hung up on him for a really long time. And I got an invitation to a friend's wedding, and she's gonna get married in New Orleans. Another friend's wedding in New Orleans. What are the chances? And she was getting married on the day I was mugged. What are the chances of that, right? 5 years to the day that I got mugged at gunpoint. You gotta be kidding me. Destiny. Destiny! So I emailed Nick. And I said, I don't know what to tell you. I'm gonna be in town. There's another wedding. 5 years to the day. What do you think? Like, I think we should see each other. And he wrote back and he was like, that would be great. I would love to see you. can I bring my wife? And I was like, wow. And I realized at that moment I did not want to see him and I did not want to meet his wife. And I totally understood why that was what I just, no. And I just wrote back and I said, that's so kind. I don't think that we should meet. This was a mistake. I apologize. I had no idea. I felt like it was a gift. Because I could finally let go. Because that wasn't mine. All that time, I had been like, but we had this true love and we got derailed and we need to get back together. And then it was just like, oh wait, no, you're not hanging on. You have a wife now. Like 3 years had passed since we had broken up at that point. And I'm released. I don't have to hold on to this anymore.
Sarah Heppala is currently working on her second book. It's a memoir about being single, titled Unattached. She also reported and hosted the new podcast for Texas Monthly called America's Girls. It's about, what else? The Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. If Davey Rothbart's voice is familiar, it's probably because he's a frequent contributor to public radio's This American Life. He's also the creator of Found magazine, a best-selling author, and an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. In his mid-20s, Davey rented the attic bedroom of a house he shared with roommates. And during this time, he met a woman. The relationship would lead to one of the most terrifying days of his life. Here's Davey.
So when I was about 26, I moved back to my hometown, and I actually lived there for about 10 years in a shared house a few blocks from my old high school. And it was really kind of nice to be back in my hometown, see so many old friends all the time. But also, you know, I'd been gone a few years and a lot of new people had moved to town. And I went by this place where I used to work and I met a woman who worked there now. And we kind of hit it off and we, you know, hung out a couple times. I don't know. I think we just went to like a party together. Maybe we went to see a movie. And, you know, we were kind of vibing. She was about my age, maybe a few years older. And I found out that she was married. But she told me this one night we'd been drinking, going to these parties, and she basically told me that her husband was this just rageful, abusive dickhead. And it was, you know, it was just really upsetting hearing her stories. And, you know, I just was trying to give her some encouragement, you know, like she'd obviously been through some really rough times. And somehow he not only was physically menacing toward her, but had obviously exerted some psychological control, because she had a good job where she made really good money and they had two young kids, but he had made her believe that if she ever left him, she would just, you know, be poor, broke, and just totally helpless. So I just tried to give her some advice as a loving friend, basically. Now, that being said, we also made out maybe that night, maybe the next time we hung out. I was drinking a lot during that period of my life, and she came up to my room once, and this is a house I share with like six friends. So, but then, you know, I didn't see her for a few weeks, and I was kind of like, well, you know, whatever. This isn't necessarily something I want to pursue seriously romantically, but I let her know I was available as a friend if she ever, you know, if she ever needed someone to lean on. A month or two later, I woke up at the crack of noon. And I heard a voice, a male voice. there's a guy towering over my bed. He looks like Ed Harris. I thought it was Ed Harris at first, the actor from Apollo 13 and other good movies. But it wasn't Ed Harris. It was just a man. An older man, maybe in his early 40s or something. Older than me. I was, you know, mid-20s at the time. The guy is wearing gloves, leather gloves, and he's staring at me like he's going to fucking kill me. I thought it was an intruder, just like a burglar in a house or something. I really had no idea what was happening. And he's like, hey, do you know who I am? I was like, no, can I help you with something? You know, I'm kind of start sitting up. I'm in my boxers in my bed in this like attic bedroom, and he's kind of like towering over me. And, you know, he just started talking a little bit, and he said, give me a reason why I shouldn't kill you. And I was like, ah, oh, man, I don't know you. I don't know why you would. I mean, give me a reason why you would. And it basically comes out that he is this woman's husband. And he had known that she had like hung out with me a few times and kind of, I don't know, maybe heard through somebody that we were making out at a bar or something like that. And then he had, I guess, grilled her. He had grilled her and made her basically spill the beans on like every last detail of everything that had happened that night that she came up to my room. I don't think he knew what was going to happen. And it's really hard to get up to my little attic bedroom. Like, I think as he was probably coming up those little stairs and, you know, he must have forced her to like map out my house because there's six roommates, you know. And I still am mad at my old roommate, Andy, because the guy came to the door. And the guy, who had murder in his eyes, said something like, oh, is Davey home? And Andy was like, oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead upstairs. And he just... then Andy went off to class and just left me alone in the house with this guy who very easily could have killed me. So for the next hour, in probably the most terrifying hour of my life, the guy is standing over my bed, and I'm basically just trying to stay alive. I mean, I'm genuinely apologizing. I'm terrified. He's asking me for these really graphic details of what happened when, like, you know, did you go down on her? Where was she laying? What was... And the other thing is he kept threatening me not only to kill me, like, in the moment, but he also... He had this weird thing. He kept talking about how he would push a bottle up my ass until it broke up my ass. But he mentioned it probably like 40 times. I mean, it was clearly something he really badly wanted to do. And I just basically tried to look for a crack. And at some point I realized that, you know, what he was most threatened by, I think, was the idea of his wife leaving him, which I had totally encourage her to do, not to be with me, but just because she shouldn't be with some abusive jerk. And he came up with this theory at one point, which I latched onto immediately. He basically said, it seems like you're a guy, you were drunk, you were just trying to get your rocks off, right? And I really liked this woman. I had some romantic interest in her. I thought she was a really special, smart, cool, wonderful person. But I saw that I had maybe an escape hatch, which was that if I could make my interest in her be completely just based on, you know, like hormones and just wanting to have sex with anybody, and here was some random person that presented themselves as an opportunity, that he would maybe feel less threatened that like she was going to run off with me or something, which is not what I ultimately wanted either. So I just kind of was like, yeah, man, that's all. Like, you know, I'd start drinking and I'd just get turned into such a horn dog. I just want to hop on anything, you know. And I just kind of kept going up that alleyway. And the other thing I was trying to do was get him out of my bedroom where he could have just killed me and left the house. I wanted to try to get him into a public place. So I told him like I had to really pee badly and I was just going to like pee on the floor if I didn't get out of the room. So I got us downstairs where I peed, and then I was like, man, I want to keep talking to you about this stuff, but I'd feel better if we could just go stand out in the park. There's like a park across the street. So he somehow let me move us, pull my shoes on and move out to the park. Because I was like, this conversation's important. I want to keep talking to you about all this stuff, but let's just go over there. I might have said I had to give my keys to somebody, or I don't know what I said, but I got us out into the park. And then there's all these little kids running around and their parents. And me and him are just sitting on a park bench continuing this intense discussion. And now he's just threatening me, you know, the things he could do to me in the future and the way, you know, he knows where I live, the ways he can hurt me. But slowly over the course of an hour, he wore down and he backed off. And basically at the end, we just shook hands and he was like, you know, never talk to her or see her again or anything. And, you know, selfishly, you know, I agreed to it, even though I was very concerned about her safety and her well-being. I mostly just wanted to say whatever it would take to get the guy to leave me alone. So I shook his hand and I was like, dude, I will never talk to her again. I'll never see her again. That's it. We'll never run into each other again. And he seemed satisfied mostly. And he just said, okay, well, I'll be watching you. I'll be keeping an eye on you. And, you know, I laid low, and months later, I heard that she had left him. I heard that she left him, and I heard that she found a better path, and she lives with her kids, and they're all doing great. I feel ashamed that I didn't take a more active role in trying to help her find safety, but I also feel like I'm glad if that some things I said to her maybe helped penetrate, or even just the act of, you know, her making out with me somehow, you know, if that was a catalyst somehow for this break. But I think the guy, when he came up into my bedroom, like, I think he probably thought there was like a 50-50 chance he was going to kill me. So I'm glad I'm still here to tell the story.
Davey Rothbart continues to stay busy on a variety of projects, but has received the most recent acclaim for his documentary, 17 Blocks. The film chronicles two decades in the life of a Washington, D.C. family living in one of America's most dangerous neighborhoods, just 17 blocks behind the U.S. Capitol. If you've read the popular comic strip Jumpstart, about a policeman and his family, then you've seen the widely syndicated work of Rob Armstrong. But while Rob's drawings are picture perfect, his personal life hasn't always stayed so neatly between the lines. Things begin to change the day an unwelcome visitor showed up on his lawn. Here's Rob.
I lived in Philadelphia, and I lived in a beautiful home. And, you know, it was one of these pop-up development, you know, McMansions, like a lot of McMansions. They kind of usually look all alike. These all look different. And it kind of gave us a nice feel in the place, and I loved it. Dream come true. I was married before. It's my second marriage now. But it was not to last either. It didn't get wiped out by fire or anything like that, or floods. It got wiped out by a divorce. And the weirdest thing about that was when things started to go south, a peacock showed up at my house. Now, this is a big development. Almost no one had fences or gates or anything. And this peacock showed up at the house, a gorgeous male peacock. I said, oh, this is so weird. There's a peacock at the back door. And it was just standing there looking into, we had a glass door downstairs, and he was looking into the basement. It was beautiful. You know, male peacocks are the ones with all the feathers and the colors. It was purplish blue in body and yellow toward the bottom, a little greenish around the neck. Gorgeous, like turquoise in the middle. And just every color in the rainbow when he opened his feathers up. Stunning. Now, you don't see the feathers open that often because they're doing that to show off for females. It was just a weird bird, man. There was no reason for a peacock to be there. There was no nearby zoo, but the nearest one was, you know, 15, 20 miles away. I called them and said, I don't know, maybe a peacock got away off a truck. I don't know. Can you come and get it? They said, we don't have any peacocks at the zoo. I said, can you come and get it anyway? Just take it to the zoo or something? no, no, we can't do it. Every place I called refused to take it. The peacock claimed my property. And it was cute for about a week, you know, but peacocks are loud animals, particularly males, you know, when it's mating season, they start literally screaming for a mate. They let out a yell that's not like a bird. It sounds more like a baby crying. And this will go on all night, literally all night. You just hear this wail of a baby crying. And I was just like, I got to get rid of the peacock. I don't want to kill it. I don't even know how to kill it. The thing is huge. It's like killing a person. I don't want to kill this thing. Maybe I'll capture it. So I set traps for it, stick in a box, some food and all that. Nothing worked. Peacocks also poop everywhere, like a lot, right? So my car would just be covered in. A black SUV would be turned white almost from poop, like every square inch of it. So I've got to get rid of the peacock. It was a strange time just overall. You ever have something happen, like a household accident, but you don't get hurt at all? Like, but it's so close. It would have killed you. So I'm opening my garage. Again, during the time when the peacock was living in my yard, I'm opening my garage with a remote. You know, you press the button and it opens. I don't have an, you know, it's not an old house. It was built in the 90s. And this garage moved using giant springs. Like the springs were 5 inches in circumference, right? And it was one on each side. I stepped out to my garage, pushed the button to open it, and one of these springs detached and it shot at me like a gun. It missed me. I mean, missed me by about a foot, but it went through 2 layers of drywall. It would have killed me. Guess who was living at my house at the time? The peacock. Every weird thing during that period of my life, the peacock was there. We had an argument once. This peacock had driven both of us kind of crazy. But we had this massive argument, right? And literally, I called the police. I was like, officer, just come to the house. Settle things for us. You know what I mean? It's out of control. The neighbors were on their lawns. It was loud. It was nasty. It was me mostly yelling. Anyway, but I called the cops. And when the guy came, he was talking to me, saying, what's the issue? Blah, blah, blah. And my ex got infuriated because it sounded to her like he was siding with me. But he wasn't. He was just talking to the guy who called the cops. You know what I mean? And then she... I'm going to report you. You're not handling the situation right. And he did, because we stopped arguing and fighting. We did. And that Saturday, like that following Saturday, that guy, that cop, went head first into a tree, crashed a squat. He was killed instantly. Like that dude. I just turned on TV and he was on TV like a week later. I hate to say this guy died because of a peacock. I would just say that there was a shadow, there was a looming quality that this bird had. You hear raven, you know, being categorized as being like this, or vulture. Peacock is beautiful. You know, you don't think it's anything like this. The marriage began to show all the stresses leading to a divorce. As it started to go south, I noticed that the bird became more and more in crisis. Like, as we got unhappy, this bird got louder and crazier. It would start to run around. It would start to shed. This may be because it was unsuccessful finding a mate. I was unsuccessful finding a home for it, but I'd give it water, I'd give it bird feed. The marriage became out of control, and we ended up getting divorced. As soon as we filed for divorce, this peacock, I had set this rudimentary box trap, but it would never go in. If it did go in, it would do it at 4 o'clock in the morning and eat the food. I don't know. As soon as we filed, I came home. Peacock was sitting inside the box, waiting for me. I walked up to it. It didn't run. It didn't make noise. It didn't do anything. It waited for me to box him up. I poked holes in it. I literally picked the box up, laid it down on him, poked holes in it, slid another thing under it. And I took it to an animal shelter, one of the ones who said they wouldn't take it. I just literally just took the peacock to the animal shelter. It was completely content. It was some sort of harbinger of bad things to come. And once these things came, its job was done. And it just said, okay, I'm ready to go.
You may have seen Rob Armstrong in the Apple Originals documentary, Who Are You, Charlie Brown? In it, Armstrong talks about his friendship with Charles Schulz, including the life-changing moment Schulz asked his permission to use the cartoonist's last name for the Black Peanuts character, Franklin Armstrong. Since the documentary's release, Peanuts Worldwide has begun providing endowments and scholarships for Black artists as part of the Armstrong Project. Another part of the project? Armstrong himself will mentor and guide students. Strange is produced by me, Jason Reimer, and Jeff Whittington, who also edits the show. Strange was created by me and Jason Reimer. Jason also composed our music. Additional music provided by Talented Friends Productions. You can find all of the details in our show notes for this episode. Our artwork is by Rob Wilson. Additional audio provided by Spoke Media. And special thanks to Edward Medellis. If you like Strange and want to help support this work, please rate and review us wherever you're listening. And tell all of your friends. It helps others find the show. And if you have your own strange story, I want to hear it. Please drop me an email or a voice recording through my website, strangepod.com.